Good evening. It's Saturday, April 25th, with Sharon Sobota. I'm David Rosenberg, and this is the KPFA Evening News. More than 198,000 people have died from COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus, while some 2.8 million infections have been confirmed in at least 185 countries and territories. Almost 800,000 people have recovered to date.
The United Kingdom's Department of Health has announced that more than 20,000 people have now died with coronavirus in UK hospitals. The latest figures showed a total of 20,319 deaths in the UK, up by 813 from the previous day. Last month, the government's chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, said keeping deaths below 20,000 would be a good outcome.
Russia hasn't seen as many deaths from the coronavirus as some other countries, but the disease is spreading rapidly there. David Holloway is a retired professor at Stanford University. We asked him about the difference between how the virus is affecting the big cities as opposed to the less populated parts of the country.
Well, my impression is that Moscow is the main center, St. Petersburg is second, and then much less in the different regions. But we don't know, at least I don't know really what the figures mean, because how much testing has there been, how much reporting has there been of deaths that are attributable to the coronavirus. I mean, one of the remarkable things that happened in Russia on television was when the mayor of Moscow, usually seen as a close ally of Putin's, reprimanded him about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, for saying everything was under control and saying that the numbers were underreported. So many people think the numbers we have are not the real numbers, but we're often in that situation and making a judgment about the pandemic. You know, what do the numbers really mean? So what we do see, and this may just reflect the testing, is that, yes, Moscow and St. Petersburg are much harder hit than other parts of the country.
Do you think the reaction of the leadership in Russia was similar to the reaction of the Trump administration here in certain ways?
Yes, I think in a certain way there was, a downplaying of the importance. At the beginning of the month, Putin said, well, things are under control. We'll just have a kind of extended holiday in which people will get their salaries. And then people took that as meaning they would go off on their holidays somewhere. And then immediately the order came, no, you have to stay in place. This is about lockdown. It's not a holiday. So initially Putin, yes, was saying everything was under control. And then he was assigning responsibility to regional authorities. But now he has taken a more somber tone about the spread of the virus. So in some ways, yes, it's a little bit similar to the US, although of course the scale of things here is much greater. But yes, downplaying the importance and then recognizing and acknowledging the epidemic.
That's retired Stanford University professor David Holloway.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, many farmers across the country have been pushed to the desperate place of having to dump thousands of gallons of milk. Many other families have simultaneously been struggling to access enough food. These realities inspired two educators in rural Wisconsin to get creative. Beth Stay and Jackie Goplin co-founded a program called Curds for Kids with the goals of rationing cheese curds to Wisconsin students and their families in need while also helping farmers. Beth Stay says while she's not a farmer, she couldn't ignore what was happening to farmers in her community and across the country.
It was in the news all over the place, I think nationally, not just in Wisconsin, that dairy farmers were being required to dump milk because the coronavirus had interrupted their markets and caused an excess of milk in the marketplace, and there wasn't anywhere for it to go. And that just seems so wrong, knowing that there are hungry children.
Stay says everyone in her rural community is in some way connected to farming.
It's just really a very integral part of the culture in this area. If you're not a dairy farmer, you still know a dairy farmer. You know how hard they work and how much their industry was struggling even before coronavirus. And then to get hit with this on top of all that, it was just really kind of just a heartbreaking challenge to see it happening.
Jackie Goplin's family has a herd of 100. She says farmers were struggling even in pre-pandemic times.
I think it's important to know that for the last 5 years, we've been in an all-time low for dairy pricing. The price that we get for our milk, they go by hundredweight, and you know, so much per hundredweight. And to break even for these farmers, it's normally between $16 and $18. Right now, we're going to hit $10.50 per hundredweight. And that means we're losing about $12,000 a month. And yes, there's going to be some programs that will help from the government. We don't like government handouts, and they are not always equitable. In other words, we're on the small end of that chain, and we don't get near what it's going to cost to cover our losses. And then when COVID came around, it displaced some of the markets we had. Schools were, you know, not buying all that milk. That created an immediate glut of milk. And now what we're doing is trying to purchase some milk and get it off that surplus list of milk that, you know, might have to be dumped.
Goplin teaches music in the Whitehall School District, and Stay works with special education students in Arcadia, places where the number of working class families and families in need are high.
Beth and I are both in education, and in Trempealeau County, that was our focus. We belong to a four-school consortium, Arcadia, Blair Taylor, Independence, and Whitehall. And we focused on those schools first. We got numbers of kids they were feeding and figured about a half a pound of cheese curd per kid and came up with some numbers. We placed an order with two different dairies, Lynn Dairy out of Granton, Wisconsin, AMPI out of Blair, Wisconsin. Then we arranged the delivery, and kitchen staff and the food distributors at the schools were thrilled to be delivering and handing out these cheese curds, a nutritious snack for the kids and their families.
How many people are taking advantage of this program?
It's around 1,500 people, mm-hmm. and we're growing.
To learn more about Curds for Kids, you can visit curdsforkids.org.
The price of oil has plummeted during the coronavirus pandemic. Middle East oil-producing countries have been among the hardest hit. Dan Lazar is a freelance journalist who's been following the situation. He says having large amounts of oil in the ground is no longer the advantage it once was.
That was at one time a tremendous economic asset, but now it's a financial liability. I mean, that's oil, all that oil underground makes Saudi Arabia poorer rather than richer. So it's gone from being a financial colossus, not only to a financial midget, but to a financial debtor, really. Now, Saudi Arabia has ample foreign currency reserves that would allow it to keep on going for a couple of years. But the fact is that for the near future, it has no conceivable source of income. And that's extraordinary.
I mean, is that the result of being a one commodity economy, or does it go?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, the only thing that Saudi Arabia produces besides jihadis and terrorists is oil. And if anything, its dependency on oil has probably increased over the last 40 years. And as a result, it's highly vulnerable to swings in the on the oil market. And that's why this price plunge is just devastating beyond words.
So what's that going to mean for the Saudi regime?
I don't know how it can survive. I mean, you have a crown prince who is a vicious despot, you know, imprisoning people, killing people, et cetera, et cetera. So this is Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist who was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. But he's also a lavish spender. I mean, he's a guy who plunks down $500 million for a yacht that he happens to spy off the southern French coast. He plunked down $300 million for a French chateau. He spent $500 million on a Leonardo da Vinci painting. So this is a guy who spends on a scale that you and I can barely comprehend. But now he's penniless. Now he has no money coming in.
And what about these other countries, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Iran, Iraq, are they in as bad a position?
Yes, they're all in terrible positions. I mean, first of all, I mean, the countries like the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, or Qatar built their prosperity. They've been much more successful than the Saudis have been in diversifying and branching out. But still, ultimately, their income comes from energy. And now that income is vanishing. because it seems as if the world probably produces roughly 40% too much oil per day than it can use. And so therefore, their whole economic raison d'etre is vanishing as well.
That's freelance journalist Dan Lazar.
This week marked the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, but the yearly celebrations looked very different this year amid the global pandemic. Social distancing rules haven't slowed down climate activists and environmental organizations. Instead, they took their message to the masses online. The fossil fuel industry has seen a massive decline in business, and activists say it's time to divest and shift to more sustainable sources. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
As major cities and continents continue to grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, the planet is getting a temporary reprieve from human pollution and congestion. Carbon emissions have seen a dramatic drop worldwide, and air quality has improved in major cities like Los Angeles and Mumbai. But the fossil fuel industry is facing a crisis of its own as demand and consumption for oil continues to tumble. Countries that rely on oil scramble to deal with falling oil prices, and oil producers struggle to find storage space. Climate activists say now is the time to cut financial ties from fossil fuel companies and focus on finding cleaner and more sustainable energy sources. Fossil Free California is a climate nonprofit group. The group joined a coalition of over 91 groups for an online campaign titled Stop the Money Pipeline. The campaign featured online sessions with speakers and activists from the U.S. and Canada, covering topics about pension funds and large investors in fossil fuel. Sandy Emerson is the board president of Fossil Free California. She says the only way to make a lasting impact on the climate is to cut financial ties with the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, back in 2012, Bill McKibben of 350.org started a Do the Math tour telling people that if we keep digging up, extracting, and burning coal, oil, and gas, we will cook the planet. And so we work to get investments out of these extractive industries because big oil and the fossil fuel industry, their business model depends on always going after more fossil fuel. The only way to make an impact on this is to remove the financing for their fossil fuel project. We have to stop extracting fossil fuel. So we are trying to take the money away from that equation, which then would make it available for investing in a just transition to a low carbon or no carbon economy.
Emerson says this is a time to stop and take stock and look for other solutions that will benefit everyone.
We are in a healthcare crisis at the moment, a health crisis brought on by the pandemic, and that is within our larger and ongoing crisis, planetary crisis caused by global warming. We are all having an enforced opportunity to stop and take stock and proceed thoughtfully. And yet, the organizing for Earth Week virtually was, in my opinion, extremely powerful and extremely effective. So in a way, we're connecting remotely with lots and lots and lots of people that we might not otherwise have had a chance to meet. So it feels to me that there's a national community, there's a global community now, and we are all realizing that our crisis is a crisis within a crisis, and this is our moment. When we come out the other side, we need to be working for a just green recovery.
To learn more about the organization, you can visit their website at www.fossilfreeca.org. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
And you are listening to the evening news on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and KPFA.org. With Sharon Sobota, I'm David Rosenberg. The Party for Socialism and Liberation today sponsored a car caravan in San Francisco to demand the cancellation of rents and mortgages statewide, immediate housing for all, and full aid and rights for the undocumented. The COVID-19 safe caravan wound its way through neighborhoods like the Bayview, the Mission, the Tenderloin, and Chinatown, with cancel the rent signs and banners on cars and windows. Gloria LaRiva is with the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
For ourselves in the Party for Socialism and Liberation, in conjunction with many, many other groups across the country who are seeing that in the first month alone of this pandemic, that in April 1st, 30% of the population couldn't pay the rent. It's bound to double by May. And the prospects for the now 22 million people who have applied for unemployment, and I do believe that that fund is going to run out before the 26 weeks, that the working class is facing an extreme crisis. Not just those who rent, but those who are buying homes, those who have second mortgages, and the people who are homeless, the people who are undocumented, who are not entitled to any assistance at all. In fact, I don't know if people understand that in the CARES Act, it is specified that in a family, if there's one undocumented member, then the whole family, whether they're a citizen, especially the U.S.-born kids, are not entitled to the $500 as children, and the other adult members of the family are not entitled to $1,200, which is a pittance anyway, but it's very important. And so it's a war on the poor. It's a war on the working class.
LaRiva says the campaign started with a statewide petition to Governor Newsom calling for the cancellation of all rents and mortgages as long as the pandemic lasts. At around that time, the governor declared a two-month moratorium on evictions, but his declaration was superseded by a state court ruling that said nobody can be evicted during the coronavirus emergency for any reason unless public health and safety is threatened. For more information on the Cancel the Rents campaign, you can go to www.canceltherents.org.
6 weeks into the pandemic, business owners across the country are having to get creative or close their doors. Mark Weinstein is a co-founder and co-owner of Amoeba Music, the world's largest independent music store. He says that he's fighting to keep the business alive for the sake of music lovers around the world.
Pre-pandemic, we had three very busy stores that were still kind of the last vestige of a really important culture in this country. You know, we've always kind of represented all the small independent stores in the U.S. We're just a big store, kind of trying to put all of that culture all under one roof, all those different genres, and just do the subject justice. And therefore, we're a really big operation, and we have, you know, a lot of expenses, over 300 staff, and you know, a cumulative rent that runs well over $300,000 per month. So we're going into the hole pretty fast.
Talk about what this moment of being frozen in time looks like. How are the mail order music services working, etc.?
We have 300 staff at the three stores. The mail order department is a total of 12 or 15 people altogether. That's still operating, but it's minuscule compared to the big operation. And so all of our staff is on unemployment, and we're not able to avail ourselves of much of the stimulus money because you have to have kept your staff on or rehired them by May and June. Basically, the government's offering loans. We have secured a loan for our Berkeley store and for the other stores, but those loans have to be paid back. So it's not really like we're getting any free help from the government, that's for sure.
What are you doing to secure your future operations so that your store can stay in business?
Well, one of the few ways we could think of to try to bridge the gap between now and the time we're able to open was to start a GoFundMe campaign, which started about 4 days ago. Our goal is $400,000, which represents, either a couple months rent or about a month and a half worth of payroll, and just to help us bridge the gap between now and whenever we can reopen. It's even $400,000 would not really be sufficient, but in combination with government loans or whatever else we can get, we hopefully can get there.
So on that note, it sounds like maybe your customer base might be who's contributing, and you said they're not necessarily people who are super wealthy. What is it that would make somebody give their sparse funds to an independent music store?
You know, there's so much love on both sides of the counter for the product itself, which is music. It's humankind's most accessible art. It's music. It's how we all can relate to each other. I've been in this business 45 years, And when I put the tone arm down on a turn on the record, I'm still blown away by the magic of it. The store that's in LA has probably 500,000 records, and the store in Berkeley has over 100,000. So it's just a tremendous resource for a community that loves music and records. It's meant a lot in all three communities that we're in.
Is there any part of you that worries about the possible need to shut down the business?
Of course. I can see how many, many small businesses are not going to be able to survive this situation. We have a lot of weight in that we carry a lot of expenses, and it's going to be a real challenge to try to get there. But we really want to, and you know, our customers, more than we could have even believed, are supporting us and helping to send us that message. You got to be there when all this ends. Please, please, please. We're about the only venue where artists of significant stature can do an in-store performance in a record store, because we have stages with good sound, and we can handle a lot of people at once. We try to support musicians every which way we can. We're not like a corporate store with an ethic that is all about making money. It's really about helping to support a culture that we all love.
That's Mark Weinstein, the co-founder and co-owner of Amoeba Music. To learn more, you can visit Amoeba Music's website.
Assembly Bill 5, which went into effect this year, was designed to help gig economy workers by reclassifying them as employees rather than independent contractors. But there have been complaints from groups like independent truckers, musicians, and filmmakers about the burden the law places on them. Eve Ma is a Bay Area filmmaker. She says AB 5 raises the cost of doing business by 20%.
What that means is either lots fewer independent filmmakers or people using less crew. Oh, and in addition to the 20% financial end, there's also all this paperwork that you also have to do with, which, you know, is another use of time. And so it's going to put a crimp on a lot of things. It's going to make a lot of independent filmmakers either not use the crew that they had intended, and therefore potentially make less higher quality films, or it's going to make them say, the hell with it, I've never made any money off of this anyway, you know, I've just done it for passion, but if my passion is going to cost 20% more, I think I'll find another passion. It's just a big problem. It's hard to make do as an independent filmmaker. Most independent filmmakers do not make a living making independent film. They have to have some other form of income. I mean, a few of them make it big, but most of us don't.
So I would imagine then that people have organized to challenge this law in court or to put pressure on the legislature to amend it. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know if you read a couple of days ago, there was a newspaper article. The music industry has put pressure on the legislature to exempt gig musicians. You know, and in my view, independent filmmakers are very similar to gig musicians. You know, that's your group or your person that's playing in your local cultural center, or, you know, that's playing in a restaurant or a bar for a minimum amount of money. And all of a sudden, if you have to classify them as employees, you're just not going to use them anymore. And so gig musicians are presumably going to be exempt when the assembly comes back into session. There are a couple of sponsors of the bill, and it was the music industry itself that got behind this. The film industry is not organized the way the music industry is, but I would think that film organizations, I belong to a couple, and I've suggested that they might want to look at this, and film festivals, because film festivals really depend heavily on independent filmmakers, except for, well, even film festivals like Sundance, you know, to get the legislature to exempt people whose budget is below a certain level, or who are using a camera person for, say, you know, 10 half days a year. And it's just counterproductive to have to put that person as an employee and pay the extra 20% of money. And it's not good for the crew members, and it's not good for the independent filmmakers, in my view.
Ma is optimistic the law can be changed if the filmmaker organizations put enough pressure on the state legislature.
India allowed shops and residential areas to reopen today, more than a month after the country went into lockdown to curb the spread of coronavirus. The federal home ministry said the retailers could resume operations with the staff numbers reduced by half, as long as employees wore masks and gloves, and appropriate social distancing was maintained. The sale of liquor and other non-essential items continues to be banned, and no shops in large marketplaces or multi-brand and single-brand malls will be open until May 3rd.
As the coronavirus spreads, we're hearing more and more personal stories about what people have experienced as a result of the pandemic, including what it's like to be quarantined. We spoke with Boston area attorney John Barker to find out what he went through.
The receptionist at our firm was, at first, I heard that she was symptomatic and that her mother worked at a law office and probably had the virus. It turned out that was, in fact, a rumor and not at all what happened. She came in not symptomatic, but her mother was symptomatic. And it turned out a few days later that her mother tested negative. You know, when I heard the first report, I quarantined in my house, and I was just in a bedroom, and my family very sweetly brought me food, and they would keep me company by sitting in chairs sort of out in the hall, and we could talk, you know, through the doorway. And obviously I had my phone, so, you know, I could text them if I sort of, hey, could you please bring me this or something like that, and everyone was very nice.
Barker says he was fortunate to have his own restroom while he was quarantined.
We have 1.5 baths, so I used the one that had the shower. And I think that everyone did use the shower in that, but they didn't use the rest of the bathroom. They used the other bathroom, the half bath. We had hand sanitizer and wipes. So whenever I finished, you know, I would wipe down every sort of item that I touched, like all the faucet handles, the toilet handle, the sink counter, the doorknobs, things like that.
Barker says he was glad his quarantine lasted only 4 days, as he was eager to spend face-to-face time with his children.
I have a kind of treat of having 2 of my 3 kids home because their schools have shut down. And then the third child lives locally, so he comes over. And I really get a lot of family time that I wouldn't otherwise get. My daughter, for instance, lives in New York, and it just so happened that she came home for a week of spring break, and then everything hit the fan, and she obviously decided not to go back to New York. It was just sort of coincidence that she came home, and I'm delighted because she's safe, you know, New York being a real hotspot. And I think she feels the same way. Although she did say to me, that was sort of interesting, that in talking, you know, doing FaceTime with her friends over Zoom or whatever outlet, there's a part of her that misses the kind of shared emergency and the kind of camaraderie of being in a, you know, an emergency together.
That's Boston area attorney John Barker.
A key government official in charge of Japan's economic response to the coronavirus outbreak called off his public appearance to work from home after it was discovered that he had been in contact with a member of staff who tested positive for the coronavirus. The cabinet office said the economy minister, Yasutoshi Nishimura, had canceled the media briefing scheduled for 5:00 and would not attend a separate meeting later in the day. In a statement, the office said it had discovered that Nishimura had visited a university hospital last week with an office staff member who later tested positive for the virus.
And the weather for the Bay Area, lows in the 50s tonight, sunny on Sunday, highs in the high 60s, lows in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, temperatures in the 50s tonight, partly cloudy on Sunday, highs around 90 degrees, lows in the 50s. And that's it for the news tonight. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Lola Okonwu and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls with Sharon Svoboda. I'm David Rosenberg. Good evening.